So I want to start just by reading the Sutta. The interesting thing about the Sutta before I read it, I'm just going to read the first sections of it here. And this is actually a Bhikkhuni talking, Dhammadina. Dhammadina was the foremost female disciple of the Buddha. She apparently often taught the Dhamma with his encouragement. And the person who's talking to her is her husband, who she left him and went and took ordination and became an arhat. And then he's coming to her to ask questions. Sort of a little bit of interesting sidelight on this whole thing. And this is just basically, the actual sutta is called the shorter series of questions and answers. And basically, her husband is asking questions and she's giving him answers, and he gets all excited if every answer she gives, he just thinks it's great. So, okay. So here's starting at verse 2 of the sutta here. Lady, he calls her lady, which is a bit odd, but lady, identity is said. What is called identity by the Blessed One? Friend, these five aggregates affected by clinging are called identity by the Blessed One. That is the material form aggregate affected by clinging, the feeling aggregate affected by clinging, the perception aggregate affected by clinging, the formations aggregate affected by clinging, and the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. These five aggregates affected by clinging are called identity by the Blessed One. Good lady, the follower said, delighted. Then he asked her a further question. Lady, origin of identity, he said. What is called the origin of identity? Friend, it is craving, which brings renewal of being and is accompanied by delight and lust, and delights in this and that. That is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for being, and craving for non-being. This is called the origin of identity by the Blessed One. So this is the second noble truth, essentially, expressed in a slightly different way. Lady, cessation of identity is said. What is called the cessation of identity by the Blessed One? Friend, it is the remainderless fading away and cessation, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go, and rejecting of that same craving. This is called cessation of identity by the Blessed One. So this is the third noble truth. Lady, the way leading to the cessation of identity, the way leading to the cessation of identity. Friend, it is called the Noble Eightfold Path. And then she lists the steps on the Eightfold Path. Lady, is that clinging the same as clinging, the same as these five aggregates affected by clinging? Or is clinging something apart from the five aggregates affected by clinging? Friend, that clinging is neither the same as these five aggregates affected by clinging, nor is clinging something apart from the five aggregates affected by clinging. The typical Buddhist answer, yes, no, maybe, all in one sentence, right? It is desire and lust in regard to the five aggregates affected by clinging that is the clinging. Lady, how does identity view come to be? Here, friend, an untaught ordinary person, that's us, who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, regards material form as self, or self as possessed of material form, or material form as in self, or self as in material form. And she goes on to go through the other four aggregates. And then in the next stanza, she says the opposite is like if you don't do these things, then that's when you don't no longer have identity view. So this thing, the five aggregates of clinging, is a central theme of the Buddha's teaching, and is also, I'm speaking personally here, one of the most difficult ones to grasp in some ways. I can sort of get a hold of it intellectually. But the deeper layers of it are still something I struggle with. So I'm going to do my best to explain it to you all because I think it's so important. First of all, the word aggregate. They call it the five aggregates of clinging. Well, I'm a construction guy, so when I hear the word aggregate, I think of big piles of stones, you know, that have been sifted. You know, there's the half-inch aggregate and the one-inch aggregate, and, you know. And actually, another translation you can see for the word aggregate is heap or pile. So this is the five piles of stuff that we cling to. It would be a perfectly valid way to translate this. Just so think of it that way. It's like, because piles are sort of like random, messy, they're just stuff, but they're like stuff that's similar. Like, you know, if you go to a rock garden, you know, like I say, there's this kind of rock and this kind of rock and then this kind of sand and da da da. And like there's big piles of all this different stuff, but there's piles. There's nothing that holds them together except that they're all of the same nature. And I want to read something else here. This is from the Satipatthana Sutta, and in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is you know, the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness, one of the steps in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, near the end, where we're now taking to look at things from a particular point of view. One of the views we have to take is the view of the five aggregates. And here's the actual meditation instructions that the Buddha gives. He knows such is material form, such its arising, such its passing away. Such is feeling, such its arising, such its passing away. Such is cognition, such its arising, such its passing away. Such are volitions, such their arising, such their passing away. Such is consciousness, such its arising, such its passing away. So basically, the instruction is simply to know when a particular one of these heaps is predominant, and then also know when it's not. And so what we're saying here is these aggregates can become something that we actually note in our practice. This is something we can actually pay attention to. And I'm not saying that's easy, but it's like, it's something that's important enough that the Buddha separated it out in the Dhammas of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And also something he talked about all the time. In the Samyutta Nikaya, which is Samyutta means collected, the sort of collected teachings. The biggest section in the Samyutta Nikaya is the section on the five aggregates of clinging, by far the largest one. This is something he talked about more than anything else. And before I start looking at the actual what the aggregates are, why? Why was this such a big deal? Right? Why did the Buddha put so much emphasis on this particular topic? And it's because it was the way he taught people, it was skillful means to start to understand and experience not self, one of the three things you have to figure out when you're practicing. And the most difficult of the three, right? You know, impermanence, well, we can sort of grasp impermanence. You know, I can hold on to that one, okay. But when you come to not self, it's like, it's a more difficult thing to grasp. And this was his primary method of getting people to look at and understand that there was no self separate from everything else. And that the reason we get caught in the self is that we cling to these five heaps of stuff. So let's just go quickly through this list. So there's these five aggregates, right? The five piles. The first one is the material form. Anything that you'd call a thing, whether it's an actual object, a flavor, some sensation related to an object, anything that you experience on the material level is in that first pile. Everything material, without exception. So everything else, the other four piles are all mental, right? But so he puts everything in this one pile, all on material stuff. And then he says, okay, now the next one is Vedana. Vedana, what is often in the translation is translated as feeling. A better translation is feeling tone, because feeling, often we get caught in the idea of like we're having feelings about something. You know, it's more an emotional thing, but we're not talking about the emotions in this sense. Vedana really only has three flavors. It's something arises, it's pleasant. Something arises, it's unpleasant. Something arises, the experience is neutral, neither pleasant or unpleasant. So Vedana is this trivalent mental formation. It's simple in a way. And I'll talk more about Vedana in a little bit, but it's the simplicity of it that's to a huge advantage for us. It only has those three flavors. Something's pleasant, something's unpleasant, something's neutral, which means neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Neutral is easier to say, right? Then what's often called perception, or sometimes called cognition. In the text I read out of the sutta, he used the word cognition. This is like that process, that mental process of identifying something in its simplest form. We hear a sound, the mind goes bird, because we know that sound happens to be the sound a bird makes. That's perception, how perception works. It has a sense experience, and then Vedana arises around that, and then this function of perception arises, and we classify that thing, we fit it into our mental picture. Then mental formations. This is basically everything else on the mental level except Vedana and perception, which are our mental formations, but they've been deliberately separated out because they're so important. And because they're also somewhat easier to work with, to be honest with you. And some texts put a great emphasis on the mental formation of intention or volition, the mental process of going to do something. Before we act and do any act of body, speech, or mind, we have to have an intention to do it first. Doesn't matter what it is. You know, if I'm going to raise my arm, I had the intention to raise it before it went up there. Otherwise, it wouldn't have gone up there. And then when I want to lower my arm, I have to have another intention, and now it's back down. And then consciousness, which I'll spend more time with later, which is essentially the knowing, or the knowingness of our process. And basically what the Buddha says, and he says this, as I said, over and over and over again in many different ways, everything that you can imagine fits in one of these five heaps. There's nothing that's excluded from these piles. But there's no self there. There's no I in any of these piles. The I doesn't fit in any of these piles. There is no I in any of these piles. So if these five piles make up everything without exception, and there's no self, duh, guess what? Not self. But it's hard to, that's the difficult part, is to actually, you know, I can sort of say those words out loud and intellectually maybe grasp it a little bit, but not so easy. Okay. So now I want to read something else here. This I'm going to hold this book up. This is the Samyutta Nikaya. Oops, it looks backwards on my screen. This is another collection of Buddhist teachings. Samyutta, as I said, means collected discourses. It's the other book I refer to. If you think the Majjhima Nikaya is thick, you don't want to have to carry this book around because it's way even thicker. And so I want to look at this particular page here. And basically the Buddha is talking to a householder about the aggregates and why there's such a problem. How, householder, is one afflicted in body and afflicted in mind? Here, householder, the uninstructed worldling, who is not a seer of the noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who is not net a seer of superior persons and is unskilled in their Dhamma, regards form as self, or self possessing a form, or form as in self, or self as in form. So you notice he's trying to cover all his angles here. You know, he's got four different ways you can think that self might arise. You know, he's got form as self. So that material thing called my body, this thing, this is material. I regard this as self. Or self as possessing form. So this isn't myself, but myself possesses this. Slightly different angle of looking. Form as in self. So form, this is part of and contained in a larger thing called self, or self as in form. So this form has inside it something called self. Four different angles, right? All of them incorrect, by the way. But he's just trying to make, you know, this is very, once again, a very common style of Buddhist teaching where let's look at this from as many different ways as possible to make sure we've covered all the angles here, right? He lives obsessed by the notions, I am form, form is mine. He lives obsessed by these notions that form of his changes and alters. With the changes and alteration of form, there arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. So, what he's saying here, basically, is that when we view this form or any other solid object, any other material thing, as solid and self, then we've set ourselves up for suffering, because that thing always, without exception, is going to change. Everything's impermanent. So we think this is self, and then in my case, you know, this self is getting older and some things don't work so well, right? And that's just part of life, right? But we get that makes, if you regard this as self, if you believe this is yourself, then as yourself changes, it makes you unhappy. That's the essence of what he's saying here. And then he goes through the other five aggregates and says essentially the same sort of thing for each of the five. But let's look a little more closely at each of these five aggregates. I have to get another book ready here. Right. So here's another sort of a definition of material form. Material form is anything that can be affected by external conditions, heat or cold, wet or dry, etc. What we don't see, the problem, is that each of these sensations quickly leads us to the world of concepts. You know, it isn't itchy feeling, it's my foot is itchy, which is the concept of foot arising out of just the actual sensation itself. And this is what we constantly do. So I want to actually try a little experiment with you all here. Just this is a really great, simple thing to do. I want you to take your hand and put it on some flat surface, not on a leg, but on like on the cushion of the chair, on the side of the chair, on the table in front of you. I want you to close your eyes and just sort of tune into what that feel, what the sensation that's occurring right now at that point of contact. Just really pay really deep attention, just the sensation itself. Now I just want to ask you two questions. Number one is, where does hand end and table or chair or whatever your hand is resting on start? If you're just paying attention to the sensation itself, you can't answer that question. It's because all you're doing is experiencing raw sensation. What we do is we take that sensation and we turn it into my hand is on the table, or my table perhaps even, who knows? And that's how we create self. I've just created my hand on my table, as opposed to simply sensation, tingling, pressure, whatever we were experiencing. We turn all those sensations into definitions of me, of what this self is all about. I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein here. And he's talking about this concept, this idea of concepts. This is a more profound instruction than we might first realize, because it leads us from the level of concept, body, head, chest, arm, leg, foot, to the level of direct experience. We may think that we're feeling a foot or leg, but there's no sensation called foot. It is only when we go past the concept to what we're actually feeling that we can apply the next instruction. Here one knows this is material form, such as its arising, such its passing away. If we're caught in the world of concepts, then we can't just tune into the fact that, that this particular experience is one of material form. We're caught in the, my foot feels like this. We've personalized it, we've selfed it. One of the most deluding aspects of concepts is that the concepts themselves don't change. We use the same words, head, body, man, woman, whether it's today, yesterday, or tomorrow. The word remains the same, which reinforces the illusion that there is something permanent that these words refer to. Yet when we contemplate the first aggregate of material form, we clearly experience their changing nature. All of these sensations are in constant flux and change. Just once again, think of your own body, how much it changes just day to day. You know, tonight I ate too much dinner, I feel really full. Well, that's a different body I'm experiencing now than it was yesterday when I didn't eat so much, and so on. It's like, because we have these concepts, they create solidity and permanence where something is actually quite impermanent. Okay. So that's material form. So next comes Vedana, the second of these aggregates, feeling tone. And as I said, it has really only these three valences, you know, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. The interesting thing about Vedana is Vedana arises every time there's contact at any of the six sense doors. Anytime we experience anything, anytime we have a contact with material form, the first thing that always happens is Vedana arises. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's our first like mental process that arises immediately upon being aware that we've made some sort of contact at one of the sense doors. And this, first of all, Vedana is what then leads us to our habitual patterns of not acting skillfully. You know, when something's pleasant, we cling to it. We want more. We want to have more. When it's unpleasant, we want to push it away. And when it's neutral, we space out.
I'm boring. It's really boring. Let's go do something else.
That's what we do. And so all of our habitual patterns of acting in the world and acting at the level of our own mind all arise because we're reacting to the Vedana. And because we somehow don't see that Vedana is separate from the object itself. There's the object and then there's Vedana. But Vedana happens so quickly that we start to believe that it's part of the object. Like, think of your favorite thing to eat, whatever it is. You know, maybe it's a Doritos, or maybe it's ice cream, or maybe it's kale, who knows? Doesn't make any difference what it is. Just think of your favorite thing to eat and imagine someone just gave you a bowl and it's like, yum, kale, great. It's all a little bit of salt and a little, and it's like just you are eating it and it's like really pleasant, right? Then as soon as you finish that bowl of kale, someone hands you another bowl of kale and says, now eat this one. Well, now it's like, you know, that first bowl was like, ooh, my favorite thing. The second one's like, oh yeah, but I still, kale's good for me, you know, I'll eat this one too. And you, so it sort of goes from pleasant to sort of more neutral. And then just as you finish that one, someone hands you a third bowl of kale and says, now eat this one. And it's like, give me a break. And now it's a really unpleasant experience. Same object, different Vedana. So Vedana is totally dependent on causes and conditions at the moment that that sense thing, impression arises. You know, maybe you just ate a giant meal and someone gives you that bowl of kale and it's like, yeah, but who cares? It's like, it's neutral. Who cares? I just had this great meal. I don't need any more kale. Thank you very much. You know? So it's, everything changes based on causes and conditions. And Vedana, so Vedana is totally separate from the objects themselves. When we start to see that, when we start to see Vedana as separate from the actual experience, then we can start to make wise choices. I don't need to fall into that habitual pattern just because that stuff is pleasant. Because we noted the actual Vedana itself, now we can make a conscious choice not to go there. I don't have to go any further. I'm just experiencing Vedana. One of the five keeps has arisen. Vedana has arisen. Isn't that interesting? Let's move on. You know, it's a different way of being. And the reason I'm putting so much emphasis on this is one of the chief ways we can learn to stop falling into our habitual patterns. Because Vedana is so simple, it really only has those three things. It can be pleasant, it can be unpleasant, it can be neutral. The problem, of course, is it's subtle. So the mind has to be pretty steady and focused. But when it is, you can actually start to see the Vedana of the experience arising separate from the experience itself. And that becomes a sort of a skillful place where you can work with your practice. Third one, perception or cognition. And basically, this is the process where we label, something arises at one of the sense doors, the Vedana arises, and then perception takes over, essentially. And we sort of, you know, you heard a sound and you sort of run through your catalog of all those sounds you've ever heard in your life. Oh, that's a blue jay, because you've heard a blue jay before. So perception is basically the process of going through your catalog of all the previous sense impressions you had that you remember and trying to identify what that was. What was that that caused that sense impression? The problem with perception is it's incredibly inaccurate. Maybe if you're really good, you know, you might do 50-50, right? But perception is often inaccurate and often quite misleading. It isn't reliable. For instance, think of the perception we have that something is solid. Well, you know, yeah, this desk seems pretty solid here. You know, it's like we think that's all. That's what we think. And it's but that's just a perception. I mean, another little tidbit from Joseph Goldstein here. When we don't observe the five aggregates carefully, there's one deeply habituated perception that we have about the world and ourselves that becomes the origin of many inaccurate conclusions. It's a perception that keeps us from understanding what is true. This is the perception we have of the solidity of things. We believe in the solidity of mental phenomena, in the solidity of stable relationships of societies. But as long as this perception of solidity and stability is fixed, we don't deeply understand the impermanent and insubstantial nature of all phenomena. Why is this perception of solidity so strongly conditioned in our view of reality? One reason is the rapidity of the changes taking place. Things are moving so quickly that we don't see the discontinuities. And basically, we have a sense impression, and then there's like this tiny little space, and there's another one. But because we're sort of looking at the same thing, it seems like a continuous thing, when actually it's made up of hundreds or thousands of who knows how many little moments of. They are moving quickly enough across the screen of that all the images flow seamlessly into one another. That's like the frames of a film. Or when we see an electric light, we see the light as continuous rather than a flow of electrons through a filament. Another reason we don't see the insubstantial nature of phenomena is because we are usually observing things from a distance, and so not seeing their composite nature. If we look at a hillside from a distance, it's a common boulder thing, right? If we look at a hillside from a distance, all we will see is a mass of color. As we come closer, we will begin to see individual trees, then parts of trees, and then on a cellular or molecular level, no trees at all. On this level, the perception of solidity, even the idea of tree, has disappeared. This is the same with all objects of experience. They seem solid only from our one limited perspective. For this reason, the view of solidity is called the hallucination of perception. Big words there. But this is something we do literally all the time. Part of the problem here also is that we all think we're really good at this. We all think our ability to perceive things is just, we got this figured out. I know those other people, they can't, you know. But just talk to anyone in law enforcement about five different people giving descriptions of the guy who just ran by them after robbing a bank. And you'll get five totally different descriptions. Short, tall, different colored hair, different colored clothes, da da da. And we all think, no, I saw that. I know what I saw. There's a really interesting experiment that was done at a university, I forget exactly where, that was basically trying to understand why perception is so unreliable. And what they did is they got just a bunch of people and they sat them down and they each had an individual screen and they were showing on the screen a bunch of basketball players and a basketball. And the instructions they were given were to count the number of times they passed the ball. Straightforward, right? So they were just, everybody was watching the screen and counting, and they were passing the ball pretty quickly, and they had to really, you know, concentrate and pay attention. And then in the middle of the video, this guy in an ape suit walks into the middle of the video, walks across, waves at everybody, and walks out the other side. And then afterwards, after they'd all seen the video, they were asked some questions. And one question was, did you happen to see some guy dressed in an ape suit? And the vast majority of people said, no. They were so focused and so concentrated on the task at hand. This is called focused perception. They were so focused on what they were doing that they didn't even see this guy in an ape suit walking through and waving at everybody, right? And it gets worse, because then the experimenters told these people, no, actually, here, let me show you the film again. But, you know, now don't do that exercise of counting the number of passes. And sure enough, there's the guy in the ape suit, and everybody sees it. And a bunch of the people, a lot of the people said, this must be a different video. Couldn't be the video I saw, because they couldn't believe that they didn't see it the first time. That their perception was that off. That's the problem with perception. We believe that we've got it, that perception is very accurate and very reliable, and it's not at all. It's totally affected by things like the task at hand, you know, which is, by the way, this is really a good thing. If we didn't have focused perception, I wouldn't want to drive in a car with you if you didn't have focused perception, for instance. We need to have that capability. It's just that we forget that it can, even though it's useful, it can also get in the way. Ah, okay. So that's perception. Then we have all mental formations except Vedana and perceptions. This is everything else that arises at the level of mind. And here, the problem of what I'll call selfing, which is actually sometimes I actually note when I really see this, I note selfing as a useful note in my meditation practice. Like, oh, there I'm selfing. I'm creating this sense of self. And it's most obvious when we look at the language we use when we are either describing to ourselves or describing to someone else something we've experienced. We make our sense of I, of the separate self, is really strongly reinforced by our own language that we use. For instance, I'll say something like, I am happy, or I am sad. So I'm having this mental formation, this emotional experience, this mood of sadness or happiness, and I turn it into I am that. As opposed to, here's this different language you could use, and this is an interesting experiment to try sometime, where instead of saying I am happy or I am sad, you could think, you just say happiness has arisen, sadness has arisen. Now it's not personal anymore. It's not who I am. I'm not at this moment the sad person or the happy person. It's just, this is what, if we think of mindfulness as paying attention to what is arising in the moment, this is what's arisen in the moment, this sensation of sadness, this mental formation of happiness or sadness or whatever the mental formation is. And that's all that's ever happening at the level of mental formations. It's just this constant flow of stuff. You know, we have to somehow learn to think of ourselves not as this solid thing, this I, but as this process, this continuous, ever-changing process. If my sense of self is simply this process itself, then there's much less gripping going on. If I'm just identifying not with the solidity of things, but just with the process itself. And as I mentioned earlier, often in discussions of this particular piece of the skandhas, of the aggregates, is that the mental formation of volition or intention. And the reason they are often given such strong emphasis is that they are very much part of the idea, I'm in charge. I'm the one doing this. Arises directly out of volition and intent or intention. And that is one of the strongest identity view things that grips us. Is the sense that somehow I'm in charge. When, by the way, you're not in charge at all. Your stuff is just happening. And the best you can do is maybe skillfully react to what's happening. That's all. You're not in, you never have been in charge. Which, by the way, it's also, can you think of this as a great relief? You know, we think of all this stuff that's arising in the mind all the time. And if we think we're in charge, then we're responsible for all that junk. Oh my God, it's, you know, and now it becomes my fault, and oh my God, and da, da, da. Instead, it's like, well, this stuff is arising. Now, my task is to skillfully work with it, see it for what it is, this impermanent arising, and not get caught by it, not self around it, not solidify around it. What a relief. I'm not responsible for all that stuff. I just have to work skillfully with it. Yeah. Because I'm not responsible at all. I mean, what arises in our mind is totally random. Absolutely, totally out of our control. But that we somehow think that because I form intention all the time, that I'm in charge. And that intention is often just the reaction to what's happened just before. Causes and conditions caused me to form that intention, and then I did something. That's all. Or I didn't do something, because often we have intentions and then we don't follow through at all, of course. That's a separate issue. Ah, so the fifth of these heaps, this is consciousness. And this is, I've got this written down in capital letters, that which knows. With a capital K. That's which knows. And we identify with this aggregate because it seems continuous. Consciousness seems to always be there. It's always there, we think. But actually, consciousness is these discrete moments that arise when something arises at one of the sense doors and we perceive it, some mental formation forms around it, and then that's what consciousness is sort of keeping that all together and flowing. But it isn't solid and steady at all. It's just these discrete little blitz now, 20 times a second, probably. So it's kind of hard to see the fact that this is separate, which is why it seems so continuous. But it isn't continuous at all. It just seems that way. So this process is always going on. So this is a process, and the process of consciousness is always going on, but it's going on in these discrete, tiny little moments, totally arising based on causes and conditions, without us having much to say about it at all. So I'm finding myself, it's already 8:25 and I've got a lot of other stuff I wanted to say here. Okay, I'm gonna skip over some stuff here because I'm not gonna get it all done tonight. This is one of those topics that you could go on and on and on forever. I don't wanna make you stay up too late. So I wanna go to, so as I said, this is in the Samyutta Nikaya, and the Buddha spoke about this particular topic in a variety of interesting ways. And all of these different ways he used, like I said, in this particular section, there's 159 different suttas just on this one topic. 159. It's like, I can't, you know, I've never, I'll be honest, I have not read them all. I haven't even tried. But this particular one, he uses these images to sort of like similes that say, here's what this one's like. And all of these are sort of immaterial, ephemeral things. And he takes each of the skandhas, each of the aggregates, and gives them a particular image that describes how impermanent and transient they are. So I'll read part of this and then I'll just give you notes on the other ones here. Bhikkhu, suppose that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam. A man with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to him to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a lump of foam? So too, bhikkhus, where whatever kind of form there is, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a bhikkhu inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to him to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. So all material things, if you think of them as just a bunch of foam floating on the river. You know, we've all seen. This is a classic thing the Buddha does. He picks these things that everybody would understand because they've all seen it. We've all seen foam floating on a stream or a river. And it's just like, it's there and it's gone. It's like insubstantial. And that's what he's saying. Think of all material form as having that same level of insubstantiability, just not there. So then, for the others, for Vedana, he uses a water bubble arises and bursts on the surface of the water. So it's raining, and a drop of rain lands on the surface of the water, and a little bubble forms, and it's gone. That's Vedana. And it's a great image because that's how fast Vedana happens. It's like, if you ever watched water like slowly dropping on the flat surface of water, it's like blip, blip, blip. It's like these little blips and little tiny bubbles, and then it's gone. But it's there very briefly. That's Vedana. It's like little drops of water on the brain or on the mind or whatever. Then here's one of my favorite ones. This is for perception. Suppose, bhikkhus, that it is the last month of the hot season. At high noon, a shimmering mirage appears. So perception is like a mirage. It's just totally insubstantial. It's just there and it's gone. And it seems real. If you've ever seen mirages, it's like when you see them, it's like, wow, look at that, whatever it is we're seeing. And then when you get closer, because the angle of the sun changes or the cloud comes in, you know, whatever it is, the mirage disappears. Totally insubstantial, only in our minds. Great image for perception. Then for mental formations, he uses a plantain tree. Now, this is, you know, if we all lived in India, we'd all get this one. But the thing about a plantain tree is when you chop it down and you start peeling away the layers, there's no heartwood. There's nothing solid in the middle. It's just layers. There's no stuff in the middle. There's no, you know, the term heartwood is actually what the Buddha uses in the sutta. And that's a theme he comes back to in many other suttas where he's talking about the heartwood, how there's all these layers around the outside of a tree. And what we need to find is the heartwood, the core, the solid core of things. And a plantain tree doesn't have any. No heartwood in a plantain tree at all. You chop it down, you don't find anything inside. Totally insubstantial. And then finally, for consciousness, this is a great one too, I think. Suppose, bhikkhus, that a magician or a magician's apprentice would display a magical illusion at the crossroads. So consciousness is like a magician's trick. It's like magic. But that's all it is. It's just, it doesn't have any permanence at all. It doesn't have any solidity at all. It's just a magician's trick. A useful one. Without it, we wouldn't be able to function in the world, but it's just a magician's trick. So I like these images because they sort of give us some sense, perhaps, of the illusory, insubstantial nature of all these things. How none of them have solidity, none of them contain self in any sense of the word. Though by clinging to them, and we come back to that, by clinging to them, we create our own sense of self out of our habit of clinging to these things. So I want to read one other thing here. I'm going to find the right page. Ah, here we go. I'm back here. And I'll read this part of the sutta, and then I want to explain why I wanted to mention it. Bhikkhus, whatever is not yours, abandon it. When you've abandoned it, it will lead to your welfare and happiness. So whatever is not yours, abandon it. And what is it, bhikkhus, that is not yours? Form is not yours, abandon it. When you've abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness. Feeling is not yours. Perception is not yours. Mental formations are not yours. Consciousness is not yours. Abandon it. So abandon is a word that you see often in the suttas. And I found this great English definition of the word abandon. It says, give up completely as a course of action, a practice, or a way of thinking. We want to abandon the aggregates. We want to abandon the clinging to the idea that our identity is bound up in the aggregates. That's the Buddha's instruction. Abandon them. Yeah. Give up completely. So I want to finish as I always do with the poem. And this, some of you may be sitting there going, why is he talking about this so much? what goes on here? This is a poem by one of my favorite poets, Dana Faltz. I read your stuff to her all the time. This one's called Touch Me. Touch me as I seek to find the core of my desire. Come to me like wind before a summer storm. Blown open, I close no doors against the breeze. Dance with me beneath the low clouds. Find me within you, above you, beside you. When the rain finally falls, I cannot tell where you end and I begin. That's a pretty good description of not self. When the rain finally falls, I cannot tell where you end and I begin. So that's the Dharma talk for tonight, all I have to say. Now I'm going to actually ask you all to unmute if you want to unmute, and we'll have some time for questions if you are interested in doing so. And so some of you have unmuted. So if you have something to say or a question, or you want to just speak to the topic a little bit, wave to me and I'll call out your name and you can say something. And as I've always said, don't feel at all obliged to feel like you need to say something. It's totally up to you. And I notice a lot of you didn't even bother to unmute, and that's okay too. So. So is anyone who got sort of interesting back? Oh, that's Ted waving. Is anyone? Go ahead, Ted.
I'm kind of feeling like what's left after you abandon everything else.
Ah.
What is it that's supposed to be left?
Just the process. Not the actual, no stuff, just the process itself, the constant flowing, changing process. There was another thing I wanted to read that I didn't get to. He talks about being in a stream and how we sort of reach out and try and grab onto things along the stream so we don't get carried away by the stream. And that's just like grasping one of the five aggregates. We're not anything other than pure process. And this is like scary as hell to even contemplate, let's be honest. It's like, because that's so contrary to how we always think. We want to have some solidity. I want to have me, please. And where this is going is taking us outside that space.
Do we make conversation with
well, it's okay. Remember that basically there are these two levels of reality, and the Buddha talks about this all the time. There's this conversation we're having right now is in the world of relative reality, where there is a me and a not me. Otherwise, we couldn't be having a conversation, right? But in ultimate reality, there's just this process going on that we're both experiencing, and that's all. There's not really, you and I aren't in any way separate, but that's at the layer of ultimate reality. And basically my understanding, and this is strictly an intellectual understanding, I'll be honest with you, my understanding of one who is enlightened is they function in the world both from the world level of ultimate reality, that's always their consciousness, but they can also function in the world of relative reality because they're still alive and they have a body and they have to sort of put food in their mouth and act in the world and talk to other people. And so they have that sort of balance. Most of the rest of us are just stuck in relative reality all the time. And this practice hopefully takes us slowly towards at least some of the time getting glimpses of absolute reality. And then more and more often we get those glimpses until one day or so, I'm told and understand, we have an ultimate realization where that becomes ultimate reality, becomes our primary reality. I can't explain it. I wish I could explain it better than that. I can't. Sorry.
Well, that don't make sense for me.
Oh, good. Good. I'm glad it made sense for you. It sort of makes sense for me too. But Sharon, waving there.
So it's kind of like it's a dual awareness all the time.
Yeah. And we're shifting back and forth between those two. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what we're trying to do with this practice is make the ultimate reality stronger in our experience. Would be one.
And weaken what we think is solid.
Well, yeah, not so much weaken it because
into the background.
Yeah, let it fall into the background and not be so important. Because if we can't function in relative reality, we can't function as a human being in the world.
Right.
We have to be able to, know, yeah, this is my hand and that's a hot stove. I better not put my hand on the hot stove. I mean, and if I was only ever stuck in ultimate reality, it's like, who knows what would be going on? So we have to function in the world at the same time, function from this place where ultimate reality predominates. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Other waving hands. Sure.
I'm Paul.
Hi,
this
Paul.
Is Paul. Paul.
Yeah.
I was thinking about some dream. Sometimes some dream might wake you up, and it might be a pleasant dream, or it might be a not so pleasant dream. And sometimes a pleasant dream you want. Oh, you might think about that. Oh, what was going on there? And maybe if I just doze off, I'll go back into that. You cling a little bit to drift back into this, or you push it away because it's a little unpleasant for you. But you're woken by this, and you're not quite sure why you were having this dream.
And tell me where this is going.
Well, that's what I'm sort of asking, you might find yourself clinging, you might find yourself pushing away, but you're really not clear really what really brought this about in the first place. So, but you're still pushing and clinging.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. We can never know what brought it about, because unless we can go back and figure out all the, I had that weird thing when I ate for dinner last night, and then I stayed up too late, and I had that argument with my partner, and that's why I woke up in the middle of the night from a weird dream. But we don't see all those causes and conditions. We just know that that's what's happening right now. We can never really know the causes and conditions that created that dream, whatever it was. That's just us wanting to have control. And we can never have that level of control. We can't know. We can only pay attention to what's arising in that moment. Oh, this is pleasant. Dreams can be quite useful. I spent a long time in my life when I was much younger writing down all my dreams. I did it for a couple of years. It was a fascinating way to see your mind in action. Scary sometimes, but fascinating.
Thank you.
Okay. So hopefully I at least vaguely answered your question there.
Yeah.
Other questions, comments, thoughts? Everybody's tired. It's late. Okay. Let's just finish by chanting a brief dedication to merit. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming and sharing me trying to explain the unexplainable. You are all very patient.
Thank you.
Let's see you next week.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you.